Welcome to the Thomistic Institute podcast. Our mission is to promote the Catholic intellectual tradition in the university, the church, and the wider public square. The lectures on this podcast are organized by university students at Thomistic Institute chapters around the world. To learn more and to attend these events, visit us at ThomisticInstitute.org.
So, like any talk I give that's not on the main philosopher I study, Elizabeth Anscombe, I'm going to start by talking about Elizabeth Anscombe, who has a very famous paper she published in the 1950s called Modern Moral Philosophy, in which she wants to encourage a revitalization of a certain both Aristotelian and Thomistic approach to moral philosophy over and against what she saw as the dominant strains of ethical thought that had become prominent in really the philosophy as ethical work as it developed in the UK since Sidgwick. And one really distinctive thing she thought was the way in which this new approach to ethics denied the existence of what we might call moral absolutes. Denied that there is any type of action, whether that be lying or theft or the intentional killing of the innocent, which are simply in virtue of the kind of action it is, absolutely ruled off, ruled out as a possible action. Wrong, no matter what the consequences would be. She contrasted this with what she regarded as consequentialism, a term that has somewhat drifted in meaning since she coined it originally in the 50s, but that essentially involves the claim that an action could, no matter what the nature of the action is, be justified if the consequences were serious enough. Now, to give you a sense for how this has continued, even to today, a contemporary deontologist whose work is quite good, Seth Lazar, he's out in Australia right now, he published a recent article in which he explains his choice for not discussing absolutist theories of deontology. And he says, I know of only one deontological philosopher working on ethics of harm who professes to be an absolutist. Everyone else is a moderate deontologist who believes that intentionally killing the innocent is sometimes permissible if the good achieved thereby is great enough. I know a couple more than one, but once you get outside of the kind of Christian ethical tradition as it's currently practiced into the broader sort of secular ethical tradition, especially as it develops in analytic philosophy, you really do not see a serious engagement with moral absolutes. You instead might say, yeah, of course you shouldn't steal just to prevent three acts of stealing, and perhaps you shouldn't kill one person to harvest their organs to save five. But if the person had enough organs to redistribute, then we might have to seriously consider what we should do. Now, Anscombe is unpersuaded by this turn in ethics, and she thinks it marks a very significant contrast because it involves a rejection of the Judeo-Christian ethical tradition, which had otherwise been the dominant tradition that had transformed the kind of philosophy and ethical work you saw in someone like Aristotle, in contrast to the kind of ethical philosophy in someone like Sidgwick. So Anscombe thinks to make sense of the transition that happens between someone like Aristotle and someone like Sidgwick, you have to see it in light of a certain notion of divine moral law. But Sidgwick has taken on that new framework of divine moral law and then lost it over time and tend to give a sort of secular story. Now, that genealogical story that Anscombe gives, that's not the focus of the talk, but it's useful just to frame one of the things that her and Aquinas are concerned to do. Namely, both Elizabeth Anscombe and Aquinas are concerned to insist that certain acts, such as acts of theft, are always and everywhere wrong, regardless of what the consequences of such an act might be. And because she thinks they're always and everywhere wrong, she thinks it's the sort of thing that you're not even supposed to consider whether you should perform them. So it's not that there's a downside to this action, namely that it's theft, and an upside to the action, namely that you could save X, Y, or Z lives. Instead, her thought is that, no, you're not even supposed to consider what consequences would accrue to an act of theft. It's supposed to be ruled out from consideration. And this is very similar to the sort of view you get in someone like Aquinas. It's also very similar to the view you get in someone like Immanuel Kant. It's what you see in Aristotle. It's what you see in a whole host of philosophers. Really, you know, the Stoic tradition, it's the dominant tradition up until about the time of Sidgwick. It even is flirted with in various odd ways by Mill, though he complicates the story given his somewhat unclear analysis of how justice works. So once we have this picture, we face an obvious problem. We face an obvious problem because it seems very clear that sometimes the consequences do matter for what you should do, even when you're dealing with things like property rights. So Anscombe and Aquinas are both willing to grant this. To give some examples, it seems clear that if you make a promise to pick your friend up from the airport, and you said you'd be there on time, and as you're rushing out the door, you hear a crying sound, and you find a baby who's been abandoned in a dumpster, and you can either run straight to your car and go pick up your friend and leave the baby, or help the baby, you should not fulfill your promise to your friend. You should help the baby rather than rush off to the airport. To do anything else would be morally monstrous. Now, it's true you're supposed to fulfill your promises, but it seems very clear that the consequences of fulfilling your promise in this case justify you in not doing so. And a similar thing is true, supposedly, of theft, according to Aquinas and Anscombe. So if you see these two blunt quotes, three-fourths of the way down the page, we have here a quote from Aquinas and a quote from Anscombe, both of which are talking about the way consequences can matter for whether something constitutes an act of theft. So Aquinas says, "Still, if the need is urgent and evident, to the point that it's clear that the need of the moment has to be relieved from the resources that are available, for instance, when a danger threatens a person he cannot be otherwise helped, then someone can licitly relieve his need from things that belong to someone else, whether those things are taken openly or furtively, and this does not properly have the nature of either theft or robbery." So the examples he's considering here are, you're starving, you don't have any food, there's a baker who has plenty of extra loaves of bread, you have no money, you cannot possibly buy one, you try to petition him, hey, will you give me one? He says, no, I have no interest in that. And Aquinas says, not only can you take the bread, not only can you take the bread furtively in order to avoid getting arrested or punished, but doing so is not even an act of theft in that situation. Similarly, we have Anscombe here. To be expected consequences may take away from the injustice of a proceeding, which would otherwise be unjust. For example, the seizure of man's property. For example, if someone catches fire and I seize your rug or curtains to roll him in to put out the fire, I do you no wrong. So here, we're imagining we're in someone's house, someone catches fire, I pull these beautiful curtains off the wall and use the curtains to smother the fire. Aquinas says, I have done no injustice to you in that situation. Now, the important thing to note for Aquinas and Anscombe here is they're not saying it's theft, but the theft is justified. To say that would be to endorse consequentialism, to say, yeah, there are actions which are prima facie wrong, but if the consequence is bad enough, then you're justified in doing what would otherwise be wrong. Or, sure, this would be an injustice, but an injustice can sometimes be justified if the consequences are grave enough. This is not what Anscombe and Aquinas say. They don't say, yes, it would be theft, but the theft is justified. They say, and in fact, it is not theft at all. Now, when you hear this, I think the natural reaction is to say that there's something deeply implausible about this move. That it's Anscombe and Aquinas being forced to give this convoluted story about, oh, it's not really theft, in order to try to justify the intuitive recognition we all have that sometimes it's okay to steal things. So here are two words. The first is that this exception, no, it's not theft, so theft is always wrong, but it turns out it's not theft if you really need it. You might say that this is a sort of ad hoc and theoretically costly concession that Aquinas and Anscombe are forced to make simply because otherwise they can't maintain the intuitive plausibility of absolutism. So they're unwilling to admit that they're not really absolutists. They're unwilling to say absolutism is wrong, but they recognize that it's absurd, and so they play this fancy language game to say, no, you can never steal. It just won't really be theft in that situation. And you might worry that this really is to sort of betray the absolutist cause. And if it's not betraying the absolutist cause, this is worry two on the bottom of the first page of the handout, if the consequences still matter on the absolutist view, then are we merely left with verbal disagreement? One person says, you can never steal, but if the consequences are really bad, it won't be theft. Another person says, you usually can't steal, but if the consequences are really bad, then it's okay to steal. What's the difference between these views? Is absolutism merely an absolutism in name only? And we can certainly say with Anscombe and Aquinas, well, there's some things they're clearly absolutist about. So Aquinas and Anscombe are quite happy, for example, to say that the intentional killing of the innocent is always and everywhere wrong. They never anywhere license the kind of scenarios where we say a bomb is ticking in New York City, it's going to explode unless you kill this innocent person. So you kill the innocent person. Right? Anscombe's very clear. She says you can't kill the innocent person in those cases. So she's willing to countenance no matter how many people are going to die. You're not supposed to kill the innocent. Aquinas seems to think it's similar. But you can't just say, okay, they're an absolutist about that. Because the really distinctive feature of Anselm and Aquinas is they don't think there's two separate types of moral rules. The absolute rules and then the other rules. Where the absolute rules are just like more serious versions of the other ones. They think all moral rules as such are absolute. They have to say this because they say the fact an act violates a rule is not some piece of negative utility that attaches to the action to be weighed against the corresponding benefits. Instead, they say the fact the act violates the rule means you're not supposed to consider the action. But if you're not supposed to consider the action, then you cannot consider the benefits that would accrue to the consequences. And so if they're going to have a plausible absolutism, which they ground not in just how bad it is to kill an innocent person, but instead ground in what the nature of the killing of the innocent is, then they need to show that the absolutism applies to all moral constraints, theft just as much as murder. And so if they're forced to admit the consequences matter in the case of theft, what story are they going to tell for why the consequences don't apply in the case of murder? The only story you'd be left with is the story you sometimes see amongst contemporary deontologists who said some rights are more important than others. So a right to property, that's like a 6 out of 312. I don't know what the scale looks like here, right? But 6 out of 312. Murder, that's like a 290 out of 312. And then like genocide, that's like 310.8. If you have that kind of view, then you might say, look, it's going to be harder and harder to justify. But if you ramp up the consequences enough, it seems like it's going to eventually be justifiable. What you need is some way to say it's not just murder is worse than theft, and that's why there's difference, but instead there's something about what the theft is that means even though that rule is always absolute, it's in fact not theft to take the property in this case. So here's our question. If the starving man cannot kill the innocent person to save his own life, and the starving man killed the innocent person to save 10 lives, and the starving man cannot kill an innocent person to save 1,000 lives, if we're going to make good on that, we have to also say, for Anscombe and Aquinas, the starving man cannot steal bread to save his own life. But it seems absurd to say the starving man can't take bread to save his own life. And so we need to tell some sort of story here. So these are our two words. And what I want to do in the first part, the first major part of this talk, is motivate why we might actually think this is not a theoretically costly concession. Why there's actually good intuitive reasons, even within the sort of intuitive secular moral framework that we've adopted, all of us, for the most part. I know we've got various seminarians here, and maybe they have avoided it, but at least that I've incurred, right? And I want to say, even within that framework, we're going to have good reasons to endorse this Thomistic line, not because we're committed to absolutism, but independent of our absolutism. So if you turn to the second page, we have a series of cases. And what I hope to illustrate is the way that a certain answer to these cases seems to require us to endorse something like the Thomistic view of property. One, number 5 on the handout, under part 1C, a preliminary puzzle about theft, and we have 3 cases. I'm going to read them and elicit intuitions. I'm not going to take a show of hands, but hopefully you will share my intuitions. If not, this talk will go off the rails very quickly. So case 1, your child is terribly sick and likely to die. There is a medicine that could save her life, but the only dose is currently seen on a shelf in Grushenka's house. Grushenka has no use for the medicine herself, she just likes to look at it. You cannot convince her to sell it or give it to you, but you could take it rather easily while she is away. And intuitively, it seems permissible to take the medication, or so it seems to me. Certainly Aquinas is going to say it's okay, because in a situation of desperate need, where that's the only way to save the child's life, it is fully justified in taking what would otherwise rightly belong to Grushenka, because there's no other way for you to acquire it. If anyone say, no, I don't need you to take the medicine, I think you're wrong. I don't really have much of an argument here, but, you know, yikes. Case 2. You and your neighbor Nikolai each have a child who's terribly sick and likely to die. There was a medicine that could save their lives, and you were lucky enough to acquire it about a month ago. Unfortunately, there's only one dose, and no less will work. Now here, I think we have the strong intuition that it's okay for you to keep the medicine and give it to your child rather than give it to Nikolai to save his child. I don't even know why you would reject that, right? Even if it was a choice you could do either, right? It seems like you can certainly keep it for your own. But in fact, most people aren't going to say not only is it okay to give it to either, but like you need to give it to your own child. That in some ways it would be wrong for you to give it to a different child when your child is in need because you as a parent have special obligations to care for your child that precede your obligation to care for other children. I came up from D.C. If my wife had not been home and I just left my kids, my 1 and 3-year-old at home, that would have been reckless child endangerment because they're not getting food. It seems plausible there are probably some other kids in D.C. who did not get enough food today, but I did not recklessly endanger them in the same way because I don't have that same sort of obligation to them. I seem to have a special kind of duty of justice towards my own children. And so we have these two intuitions. On the one hand, it's totally okay to take the medication from Grushenka to save your own kid's life. It's also totally okay to prioritize the life of your kid over the life of another kid. Now, if you accept those two intuitions, you might think that you're also going to have to accept that it's permissible to act in case three. So here's case three. You and your neighbor Nikolai each have a child who's terribly sick and likely to die. There is a medicine that could save their lives, but there's only one dose, and this time Nikolai is the one who owns it. You couldn't possibly convince him to give it to you, but you could take it from him rather easily while he is away. Now, if we accept first that it's okay to prioritize your child's life, and two, that it's okay to take something from someone else to save your child's life, then why would it not be okay to take the medication from Nikolai to save your child's life? And yet, when you present this case to people, and I present it to a great many people at this point, the vast majority say no. In that situation, it would not be okay to take the medication. You could take it in case one, when Grushenka did not need it. You can keep it for yourself in case two, but you can't take it in case three from Nikolai, who needs it to save his own kid. And here we seem to have a certain tension. It is odd to think that despite the fact you can prioritize your kid and take something to save your kid, you can't do both at the same time, which is just what case three seems to be. And we need an explanation. We need some explanation for how we reconcile the intuitive permissibilities of cases one and two with the intuitive impermissibility of case three. And here are two hypotheses that are not going to work. So, number one, we've got case four. Oh, sorry. Before that, the arithmetic hypothesis. Here's one story you can tell. My reason to save the other child and not steal together matter more than save my own child. So, I have a reason to save my child. That justifies letting the other kid die. I have a reason to save my own child. That justifies stealing. But my reason to save my own child does not justify two acts. One, letting the other kid die, and two, an act of stealing. That those two together are worse than letting my kid die, even though on their own, neither are worse. That's a hypothesis you could say. The reason why case three is different is because it has the badness of both of cases one and two together rather than separately. But that's an insane explanation, right? It will not work. And we can look here at case four to illustrate one problem with that. You and your neighbor Nikolai each have a child who is terribly sick and likely to die. You have a single dose of a medicine that could save their lives. Unfortunately, a child is severely allergic to medicine, so you cannot administer it without a special antihistamine. The only person who has this antihistamine is Grushenka, who has no real use for it herself, except that she enjoys collecting it. Unfortunately, you cannot convince her to give it to you, but you could take it rather easily while she is away. So here, you have to take the antihistamine in order to give the medication to your child. If we say no, you can't both prioritize your kid and let Nikolai's kid die and steal. Here, you have one option. Give it to Nikolai so he can save his kid. Or keep it for yourself and steal. It seems permissible to keep it for yourself and take the antihistamine. And so if the arithmetic hypothesis were the correct explanation, we couldn't satisfy this case. But no one I found thinks that if one and two are permissible, this case is impermissible. You can give other versions of this case. This one's going to be a little more counterintuitive for some people. But imagine that Nikolai has two kids, both of whom are sick, each of whom could be cured by half a dose of medication, but your kid needs a whole dose. And you own the medication. Most people think it's okay, even in that situation, for you to keep it for your kid, even though it means letting two kids die. But no one thinks that it's worse to take the medication from Grushenka than to let another kid die. And so if the arithmetic hypothesis would write, you think there's two kids who need it, then you can't keep it for your own kid, which no one seems to think. And so it seems like the arithmetic hypothesis doesn't explain the intuitions, the tension between cases one and two on the one hand and case three on the other. Here's another possible explanation, the causal hypothesis. You can't take it in case three because that would cause Nikolai's child's death as opposed to merely letting him die. And I think there's something right about this. The problem is you won't be able to explain what's right about it on its own without invoking some notion of property. And to see that, let's do two more cases. So we have case five. You and your neighbor Nikolai each have a child who is terribly sick and likely to die. Your neighbor, Katarina, has the only dose of a medicine that could cure her sickness, and she intends to give it to Nikolai. You cannot convince her to give it to you instead, but you could take it rather easily while she is away. The only difference between this case and case three is that it's not Nikolai, the child's father, who has the medication, but Katarina, who's going to do the same thing. if you think it's impermissible in case three, you're going to think it's impermissible in this case too, right? Anything else would be really odd. Yeah, you can't steal money from the parents, but you can steal money from the orphanage. That would just be odd, right? I don't know anyone who has that intuition. So case six, you and your neighbor Nikolai each have a child who's terribly sick and likely to die. Katerina has the only dose of the medicine that could cure the sickness, and she intends to give it to Nikolai. But Katerina is a good friend of yours, and you know that if she learned that your child was sick as well, she would give the medicine to you instead. You meet her on the street on your way home, and she asks how you've been lately. Here, you can tell Katerina about the situation. You realize if you do so, she will change her mind and give you the medication instead. As far as I can tell, running this by people, no one has the intuition that you should not let Katerina know about the situation. Especially if you imagine Katerina has already told Nikolai that she's giving him the medicine. Right? If you think that, then you might have the intuition in some sense Nikolai already owns it. There's been a sort of implicit contractual exchange. But if you suppose she's never expressed this intention, you happen to know this private intention, but she's not told to Nikolai, Nikolai's not expecting the medication, but you can mention to her that your child is sick, and you realize if she does, she'll give it to you instead. People seem to have the intuition that justice is permissible in case two for you to keep the medicine for yourself. So it's permissible for you to make the appeal to Katerina that she gives you the medication, even though in doing so, you are going to cause the situation to change. Nikolai's kid would have survived. Now Nikolai's kid is not going to survive because of some action you take, and your kid does. And yet we don't tend to have the intuition that's immoral. So it seems that these two hypotheses don't explain our intuition about these cases. We need some other story. And as it happens, the best story I know, in order to explain why it's permissible in cases one and two to take some medicine to save your kid and not in case three, is to appeal to the Thomistic story. The Thomistic story which says, when you're in need and the person you're taking from is not in need, then it's not an act of theft. But when it is an act of theft, there is a constraint which cannot be easily justified even by saving your own child's life. Because if you accept that, if you accept that if you need it, it won't be theft, then that explains why, in case one, it's totally fine for you to take the medication. It's not theft to take the medication from Grushenka. It also explains why, in case four, it's not theft to take the antihistamine from Grushenka. In both cases, you need it, she does not need it. Property exists first for those for whom it's needful. And so you can take it, and there's no constraint of justice prohibiting you from doing so. But when your need is the same as someone else's, either Katerina's need to give it to someone she knows, or Nikolai's need to give it to his child, in that situation, you can't take it because your claim to need does not trump the claim of need of the other person. And so we get this account which says that what's the difference in case one and three? In case one, it's not theft. In case three, it is theft. And that's what makes the morally relevant difference. This explains a set of intuitions. And as far as I can tell, the only accounts of property that satisfyingly explains intuitions are those accounts that maintain the structure. Aquinas is not the only one to do this. Lots of accounts of property, if you look through the history of philosophy, explain this distinction. In the actual paper, which if you want, you can find at the link at the top of the handout, I talk at length about Grotius's account of property, for example, and contrast it with Thomas Hobbes. Because Thomas Hobbes does also talk about what we might call a right of necessity. So those of you who are familiar with some of the more contemporary literature on this might know that the term of right of necessity is often used to describe the right, for example, people have to steal bread if they're hungry, or to break into a cabin if there's a snowstorm while they're hiking and they need shelter, or for countries to break a patent on a drug that they need to save their citizens dying of HIV or things like this. And this discussion of the right of necessity comes up in lots of places. Aquinas and Grotius both have an account which say the right of necessity kicks in when you need something and the person you're taking from does not. Hobbes gives a very different story. Hobbes says, no, the right of necessity kicks in the moment you need something because the system of justice could not require you to sacrifice your own life because once it requires that, there's no longer any rational self-interest that you could have to endorse that system of property. But that means Hobbes thinks that not only can you take the medication in cases one and four, you can also take it in case three. Because now that you're dying, your kid's dying, you're in a state of nature. And you no longer have reason to abide by the norms of property. And so you can very easily give accounts of, that say, well, if you really need it, you can take it, which are going to also imply you can take it in case three. It's very easy to articulate cases that say, no, you can't take it in case one because it's theft. But it's surprisingly difficult to give an account that explains why you can take it in cases one and four, but not take in case three, without invoking a particular view of property like that which you find in someone like Aquinas or Grotius, which articulates something about need as playing a really central role in understanding how property works. Now, we've not yet unpacked what this domestic view is, right? We need to do this, we'll do that next. And we're going to see that it has really radical implications for how we want to live. But before we do, we need to give some sketch of what the domestic story looks like. And so here we are now transitioning from part 1D, the domestic solution, to this initial puzzle, which you'll notice, I think plausibly has solved our first worry, that this claim that it's not theft is merely ad hoc, because now we've seen we have reason to endorse it, other than just to reconcile absolutism. It's also the way to explain our intuition about these cases, which are independently motivated. But we still have question worry number two, isn't this all just so much language games? And in order to show it's not, people like Aquinas and Anscombe need to say that it is internal to the logic of property that it doesn't constitute theft to take when you're in need. So here we're now in part 2a, the preliminary inquiry into property. And we're turning to the second worry. And here there's a quote at the bottom of this page of the handout from Elizabeth Anscombe, which is just a somewhat easier summary than what we get in Aquinas directly, though she is just summarizing Aquinas here. And she's articulating an account of property, which she thinks this account of property explains why it does not constitute theft to take the curtains to smother the fire that someone has been caught. She says, if someone catches fire and I seize your rug or curtains to roll him in to put out the fire, I do you no wrong. This is, again, that first part of the quote we read previously. And now she continues. This is because the resources of the earth are for the supplying of human need in general. These goods need manipulation and control to serve human need. Also, human need is served only if finished products are enjoyed quietly by individuals. For both reasons, there is property, whether corporate or private. And for this reason, infringement of it for one's private purposes is unjust. But as an extreme and urgent need, the right to it lapses. There is a right to be served by it on the part of whoever in such need, deriving from the fact that the resources are in the first place for mankind as such and in general. Now, we can unpack this a little bit by looking in more detail at the account of property given by Thomas Aquinas. And what we see in that account is that Aquinas basically gives a two-layer account. So first, under natural law, according to Aquinas, everything a person needs in order to live is hers, given by God. All necessities belong collectively to those for whom they are a necessity. This is because the existence of property rights, for Aquinas, stems fundamentally from the way in which creation was given to humanity by God for purposes of satisfying human need. So there is a prior natural right to property, which comes from the human need to control property in order to be able to survive. Now, Aquinas thinks there is also rights of property that come from human law, that don't come directly from the natural law, but come from our need to be able to have much more detailed systems of property than that which would be made available by human law in its own right. You can think here about examples like things like intellectual property. Intellectual property is not something we get via natural law. It might be made up entirely, but if it's not made up, it's a consequence of the need for positive law to give specification to certain Hofeldian incidents. We don't need to get into a whole theory of Hofeldian incidents right now, but certain moral powers to control what other people may do with certain ideas. That actually might be a little closer to copyright, but we need to get into the difference between patent and copyright law right now. Other examples of this sort of property, right? You can think about ownership over land, right, that you improve over time. It turns out it's really useful to give people an incentive to take care of their land, because if you don't take care of land, you can take out all the nutrients out of the soil, and you have things like the dust bowl. And so you want people to have a vested interest in maintaining the value of land over time. And so you might say, hey, it's actually better for each person to control one piece of land rather than each person each spring just grab some piece of land they're going to use. That's better because it means each person has an incentive to maintain the quality of that land for future farming purposes. And so you can imagine one society deciding on a certain form of individual ownership via taking commons and owning them. You can imagine another system of property which does something very different, where land is held in common. You can imagine some rather dubious systems of property where it's all held by landed gentry and then serfs come and farm it. You can imagine all sorts of different systems of property which have various benefits and drawbacks. But for people like Aquinas, there's no way to derive the details of a system of property just by natural law. You can say, look, land exists, right? Property exists, the world exists for the satisfying of human need. Therefore, there is this preliminary right that we have to make use of the world. But then there are specific rights that come via systems of human law, which give specification here. You can think about that need for specification on analogy with things like traffic laws. There's no reason to drive on the left side of the road or the right side of the road, but there's very good reason that everyone drives either on the left side of the road or the right side of the road. And so we need some way to specify which side of the road we're going to drive on. We're not committed to the claim that either us or the UK have an unjust law. Rather, both are fine, and both are fine because they are mere specifications. So we need some sort of specification of property rights. We need a specification of property rights that enables and incentivizes certain types of behavior. But, and while that can be settled by government, it cannot violate the conditions of natural law. So for Aquinas, there is natural law to property, which comes from human need. There's also human law to property, which created on top of that. But for Aquinas, an unjust law is no law at all. It's a quote you'll be familiar with. And because an unjust law is no law at all, any human law system which vitiates that natural law, which allows people to satisfy their needs against those who are luxuries, is not going to be just law, and so is not actually going to have morally binding authority. And so we get this Thomistic story where there's two layers of property rights. There's the layer of property rights grounded in natural law concerning need. There's a secondary layer grounded in positive contingent human decisions. But that secondary law only has authority insofar as it's still conforming to the minimum dictates of the natural law. And so only to the extent that it is not precluding the poor from getting that which they need when the wealthy have luxuries and extras. Now, Aquinas is not getting this idea originally from himself. Right? This is not something he pulled out of nowhere. He is deeply indebted to people like St. Ambrose and Jonathan Smith, can never pronounce his last name, who say similar things, and they were originally motivated by the sort of stuff you get in the Gospels when Christ is, for example, suggesting that if you have two cloaks, you got to give one to the person who has none. And in order to make sense of this, we originally had the very early Christian figures basically suggesting that's because you don't properly own things, God properly owns everything, and so you owe it to God to give your secondary cloak to the poor. But then in later thinkers, especially with Ambrose and then later, you don't have just the claim God owns it and he wants you to give it to the poor, but actually the poor own it in some really important sense. And so it's in vindicating this intuition that it's really, properly speaking, owned by those who need it when there are those in need that justifies this Thomistic account, which is that, and that's why they can take it. If you need something and the other person doesn't need it, it, properly speaking, belongs to you. And in order to make sense of that, he has this system of property, and that system of property tells a story. So, when you have that, we are now in a position to explain why this is not a merely verbal disagreement. It's not a merely verbal disagreement because the claim that the consequences matter has to be grounded in something internal to the logic of property rights. You have to have an account of property that explains why the consequences matter. It can't be an extra thing you tack on top of it. This is why, for Anselm and Aquinas, the consequences never justify intentionally killing the innocent, because the explanation for why the innocent have a right not to be killed had nothing to do with promoting the common good. Right? The reason why it's wrong to kill the innocent is not because having innocent people walking around is really useful to society, and because that wasn't the explanation for why you can't kill the innocent, it means that concerns of usefulness can't vitiate that right to not be killed. Similarly, it means that the consequences only matter when they make reference to human need. So suppose I could steal your fishing net, and it's a magical fishing net, and with this magical fishing net, I could, without depleting fishing stores, secure 2 million delicious lobster dinners, somehow painlessly so the lobster's not injured, and distribute these to people who would otherwise have just like salads or something disappointing to eat and now get a delicious lobster dinner instead. And so here, I can steal from you, not to satisfy human need, but because the consequence would be really great. 2 million people are going to have a bigger dinner, a better dinner. And if you say 2 million is not enough, okay, 20 million people are going to have a better dinner. Or 2 billion people are going to have a better dinner. No one needs it, but it'll make them better. And Aquinas and Anselm's like, no, you can't take the fishing net in that situation because there's no human need. It's not just the merely good consequences justify taking. Rather, only human need justifies it until we get this categorical difference between the consideration of certain consequences grounded in the internal logic of property and other consequences which have nothing to do with what we're considering here. This leads Aquinas then to draw a distinction, a really important distinction in his account of property. And that's a distinction between the use of something which is your ability to decide how it's distributed, and your use of it in your own case or for your own purposes, where you basically get to use it for whatever you want to use it for. Now, we all have an intuitive grasp of this difference. It is, for example, the difference that the American common law tradition recognizes with regards to parental rights to children's property. So if my kid, when he's 12, gets a job and makes money and keeps it in his piggy bank, I am legally allowed as his parent to come and take that money and spend it, even though he earned it, but I have to do so for his good. Right now, I get to decide what his good is, but if I say, you know what, I'm going to spend it because we need to pay your medical bills and I can't afford it, I can do that, even if he doesn't want to. Or if I say, nope, I'm going to put it in your college account, I get to do that. So I have this control over his money, but not for my own private purposes. I can't be like, I'm going to use it to go on a fun vacation while you stay at home. That would not be legally permitted. Now, of course, I could say I need the mental health break or something, and you might get into interesting legal challenges here, but we all recognize the very least formally distinction, right? You can control something, but you don't just go and use it for your own purposes. If I leave my car with a mechanic to fix, he gets to drive it around to test if it's working, but he can't just like take it on a road trip, right, without my permission. So Aquinas has this distinction and says, so the wealthy, it's true, the wealthy really are wealthy. They really do have access to extra resources. They really do control more than others. So if you have a poor man and a wealthy man, the wealthy man has use of a great many more resources than the poor man. But Aquinas says, as long as there remains human need in the world, they do not have that use for their own purposes. Instead, they have that use as a steward of it for the benefit of the poor. In the same way, Katerina, who had, right, so remember, we had those two people, Grushenka on the one hand, who had the medication, and Katerina, who had it. Grushenka just kept it on her shelf to look at it. Katerina had it and was deciding which kid to give it to. That meant that I could steal it from Grushenka and it wouldn't be theft for Aquinas. And I can't take it from Katerina because she is making use of it for the satisfaction of human need. Now, I might disagree with how she wants to use it. She might use it to save one kid, where you could instead split the dose amongst three kids who were less sick. And I might think this was a mistake, but I don't get to take it from her because she is using it to satisfy human need, even if I think there's some other use of it which might be better. In this situation, Katerina would represent the wealthy on the Thomistic picture, and me, the poor. She had access to more resources, but she doesn't get to just use the resource for whatever she wants. She can't just put the medication on her shelf to look at. She has to use it for the securing of human need. This was all for purposes of explaining the intuition that it is okay for the poor to take this property. But now we're starting to shift our attention, and we saw that this account about the rights of the poor to make use of this medication, the rights of the starving man to take the bread, the rights of the desperate in the blizzard to break into the house, the rights of the sick to steal from to take the medication from Grushenka. Those are all about the rights of the poor. Aquinas, immediately after discussing this, though, turns his attention to the duties of the rich. Because he thinks that same principle, which explains why the poor have the right to make use of these things that they need, also has an implication for the duties of the wealthy who have things they do not need. So I'll just read this quote. Once Aquinas makes this distinction, he goes on to say, for this reason, those things which someone has in superabundance are due by the natural law to the sustenance of the poor. Hence, Ambrose says, and is found in a citation which you don't need to get into right now, it is the bread of the hungry which you hold back. It is the clothing of the naked which you store away. The ransom and absolution of those in distress is the very same money which you bury in the earth. Note, the claim is not, this money is yours and you're not be very generous with it. It is actually, properly speaking, the poor's. It is for their use. You can control it only up to the point that you are controlling it for purposes of their use, for purposes of the suffering of human need. And so, at the end of this talk, I want to compare this with the account of obligations that Peter Singer gives in his famous paper, Famine, Affluence, and Morality. So, this is a very famous paper, especially in contemporary ethics. It's a little dated. He has, like, a really long discussion, this one, about, like, population control measures and, like, overpopulation worries, and he says some things that are Malthusian, just based on bad science. But he has updated versions of this in more recent books, which make the same points without the same need, and the basic point that Singer makes is, look, suppose you were passing by a lake and you saw a kid drowning, it seems very clear that you should save the child, even if it means you're going to get your suit really messy. Or even if it means that your shoes aren't going to survive, and you're going to have to get new shoes. Why? Because if you can prevent something really bad, like the death of a child, without sacrificing something of comparable value, you should do so, even if it's going to have some bad consequences. And Singer infers from this, quite plausibly, that in the same way, it would be wrong not to rescue that child, so too it's wrong for us to, for example, spend money on vacation. We can instead spend that money to buy mosquito nets in the developing world in a way that will save lives. Singer is, for this reason, a very prominent founding member of the sort of effective altruist, well, members of, not like a formal group, but a founding thinker in the effective altruist movement, grounding concerns of this sort. And in fact, Singer in that article quotes Aquinas in support of his position, saying, look, you might think this view is insane because I'm saying that the wealthy don't get to keep their money and use it on movies and vacations. But he's like, but look, Aquinas thought so too. And he's a reactionary conservative, so it can't be that weird. And I think it's worth looking at Aquinas and Singer here, because the similarities are really interesting, as are the differences. So the core of Singer's argument, as I said, is the intuitive principle that if you can prevent something bad from happening without sacrificing anything of comparable value, you should do so. He reasons that in light of the efficacy of various highly effective aid organizations, we thus have powerful reasons to forego modern luxuries in favor of charitable giving to the global poor. This is similar to Aquinas, right? In light of the poverty we see in the world, in light of the extent of human need, we have very clear duties to forego that which would be luxuries for us in aid of the global poor. But there are two differences that are worth noting. First, Aquinas insists that there is a difference in kind between our reasons to give our property and our reasons to give other things. On the one hand, we can give from what we have in surplus to alleviate need. We might donate unneeded income to an effective aid organization, for example. For Aquinas, this is a matter of justice and subject to what he calls a precept. On the other hand, I might forsake philosophy in order to study data science, in order to double the amount of money that I can make, and so double the amount of good that I can do in the world. And I might very well have good reasons to do that. I might have serious considerations to say I can do more good if I were to pursue a different line of work. But for Aquinas, while I might indeed have, those will be reasons of a different kind. And that's because my life is quite different from my property. My property, for Aquinas, properly speaking, as long as this human need in the world exists for the sake of that human need. But my life does not exist for that purposes. So for Aquinas, a failure to give in the first way is theft, and therefore an injustice, whereas a failure to give in the second way might be a failure of charity, or something of that sort. For Singer, there's no such distinction. Both choices are simply failures to sacrifice something of lesser value to prevent great suffering. For Aquinas, this is first and foremost an account of property rights. Second, Aquinas insists on a principal distinction between need and other kinds of lack. So suppose all poverty were eliminated from the world, but substantial inequality remained. On Aquinas' view, a wealthy person would still have reasons to aid the poor. For instance, a rich man might forego a fancy vacation to purchase nicer homes for families crammed into apartments. These, however, will be reasons of charity or liberality, not reasons of justice. In contrast, the sort of obligation we have to fund, for instance, basic medical care in rural Madagascar, seem to be obligations of justice on Aquinas' view. Singer, once again, does not acknowledge any such principal distinction. For Singer, a wealthy person has the same kind of duty of aid in both cases. No, there are some other minor distinctions here. So it seems like for Singer, if I could like sell my organs, I would have reason, like a kidney, I might have reason to do so if the benefits are large enough. Whereas for Aquinas, I might indeed have those reasons, but those will again not be the same sort of reasons I have to, for example, use the extra money I have, because my property rights are contingently mine in a way that my rights to my body are not. So we can put the point more generally. On Aquinas' view, if I did wrong in studying philosophy instead of data science, it was wrong because I was using my own life poorly. Similarly, if a rich man does wrong in upgrading his mansion rather than upgrading a family's crowded apartments, that is wrong because he is using his money poorly. But right now, when I keep my surplus resources that other people need, then I'm not using my own resources poorly, rather I'm misusing resources that properly belong to someone else, for Aquinas. This is a further wrong, an injustice beyond mere selfishness or thoughtlessness. And I take this to actually be an advantage of Aquinas' account over Singer's, in that it accommodates this distinction. For one thing, it takes seriously our intuition that we might sometimes have obligations to give up a career in philosophy to better serve the poor. That obligation would be different, and generally weaker, than an obligation of justice. But on the other side of that same coin, it also takes seriously just how deep a failure it is to withhold from the poor that which they need. If Aquinas is right, then a great deal of what we keep and spend is not just ill-used, but the very ransom and absolution of those who are in distress. I'm happy to answer questions.
Thanks for listening to this lecture on the Thomistic Institute podcast. The generosity of people like you makes this podcast possible. If you enjoy these talks, please consider showing your support at www.thomisticinstitute.org/donate. Your donation of even a dollar helps us reach more college students and many others with the powerful truths of the faith, and it ensures that we can keep publishing top-notch lectures on this podcast. Thanks a lot.